electricity. Current from the three cells flowed through two junctions, or buses called A and B, which distributed power to run hundreds of different components. Everything in the spacecraft, the gauges on the instrument panel, the computer, the ball valves in the service module's SPS engine, ran on electricity. Hayes checked the voltage on bus B, and the needle sank past the bottom of the scale. There wasn't even enough voltage to give a reading. As more warning lights came on, Hayes checked fuel cell number 3, the one that was supposed to be supplying power to bus B, and saw that it was dead. The mission rules were printed on a card attached to the instrument panel, but Hayes didn't even have to look at them. They were forbidden to go into lunar orbit unless all three fuel cells were working. Without being told, he knew the shattering disappointment of what had happened. They were not going to land on the moon. They had lost the mission. But this was no time to dwell on that. Hayes focused on Odyssey's stricken electrical system. His moves came instinctively now, sharpened by hundreds of hours in the command module simulator. He began reconnecting Odyssey's systems from the dead bus B onto bus A. Suddenly, another red warning light flashed on. That bus, too, was starving for current. He checked fuel cell number 1. It was now dead, too. Only one cell. Number 2 was still producing current. Lovell and Swaggart, back in their couches, joined in the troubleshooting. The command ship and the attached lander had been set in motion by the bang and were still slowly turning. Swaggart's best efforts didn't steady them, and he wondered whether some of the service module's maneuvering thrusters had stopped working. Meanwhile, Lovell checked the gauges for the oxygen tanks that fed the fuel cells and found strange readings. Just minutes ago, they had both been full. Now, tank number 2 was completely empty, and tank 1's pressure had dropped to a third its normal reading and was still falling. The dimensions of the problem grew with each passing moment. The three men had never seen so many seemingly unrelated malfunctions at once. Maneuvering thrusters out, fuel cells dead, oxygen tanks losing pressure, even the computer had hiccuped during the bang. At their diabolical worst, the simulator instructors had never served up anything like this. There was an unwritten rule against simulating multiple, unrelated, simultaneous failures. In a spacecraft with thousands of separate components, the possible combinations of malfunctions would have been so numerous that it was impossible to train for them all, and everyone had always considered the odds of such a scenario very small. In Houston, Gene Kranz was at the flight director's console, presiding over a team of flight controllers who could not believe what they were seeing. In the minutes since Swigert's first report of trouble, the situation aboard Apollo 13 had worsened on so many fronts that they suspected some kind of instrumentation failure had caused a slew of wrong readings. Even now, as they searched for some way out of the maze of problems, they wondered if they could believe their data. But that was because they were earthbound. They had not heard the bang, or felt it the way Swigert had, or sensed its reverberations as the spacecraft slowly turned in response. And if they could have seen what Jim Lovell was seeing, right at that moment, they would never have blamed it on faulty instrumentation. Lovell glanced out the side window next to Jack Swigert, and what he saw gave him a queasy feeling in the pit of his stomach. A huge sheet of gas streamed from Odyssey's side, swirling in the sunlight like cigarette smoke. For the first time, he realized the depths of the crisis. He keyed his mic. "It looks to me that we are venting something. We're venting something out into space. It's a gas of some sort." The gas was oxygen. When Swigert turned on the fans, he unknowingly triggered an electrical short inside a tank full of super-cold liquid oxygen. The bang that rocked Apollo 13 at 2 days, 7 hours, 54 minutes mission elapsed time was the number 2 oxygen tank exploding. Every one of the failures that followed was a result. The jolt from the explosion caused the fuel cell's reactant valves to snap shut, cutting off their supply of oxygen and hydrogen and starving the electrical system. It also closed valves in the propellant lines that fed the maneuvering thrusters, making it very difficult for Swigert to steady the spacecraft, which was turning in response to the propulsive action of the venting gas. It caused the computer to stop in the middle of its work and suddenly restart itself, and the blast tore out part of the plumbing for the service module's remaining oxygen tank, allowing its contents to spill overboard. Lovell and his crew did not know what had happened inside their service module, and they could not lay eyes on it. The one thing they could see, the smoky haze spewing from its side, didn't single out either a micrometeorite hit or an internal explosion as the cause, but it wasn't important to know exactly why this was happening. All that mattered was that Odyssey was swiftly dying. It was only a matter of time before the last oxygen tank was empty and the last fuel cell was dead. At that point, Odyssey's only source of electricity would be the command module's batteries, but they had to be reserved for re-entry. For Jim Lovell and his crew, the disappointment of losing the mission paled before the realization that they were in danger of losing their lives. It took Marilyn Lovell about 15 minutes to drive from the Mission Control Center to her home in Timber Cove, and when she arrived, she phoned to invite her close friends and neighbors, Betty and Bob Benware, to come over for a drink. They declined. They had just come from one of the many Apollo 13 parties thrown by the aerospace contractors, and now they were tired. After Marilyn hung up, the doorbell rang. Pete and Jane Conrad had dropped by on Pete's brand-new red Honda motorcycle. They hadn't been there very long when a call came in for Pete on the hotline, the direct link to the control center that NASA always installed in the crew's homes during a mission. As Pete went into another room to take the call, Marilyn's phone rang. It was another neighbor, Jerry Hammack, who ran the recovery operations for Apollo. "Marilyn," Hammack said, "I just want you to know that countries from all around the world have offered to help with the recovery efforts, even the Soviets." Marilyn couldn't make any sense out of what he was saying. She guessed he had been at the same party that had left the Benware so tired. "Jerry," she asked, "have you been drinking? Hasn't anyone told you?"
"Told me what?"
"The mission's been scrubbed." She felt a wave of disappointment.
"They're not going to land on the moon?"
"There's no way they can, Marilyn." Before she could find out any more, Marilyn looked up to see Pete Conrad at the top of the small staircase leading to the family room, motioning for her to hang up. His eyes were wide with alarm.
"Jerry," Marilyn said, "I'll have to talk to you later."
Pete came to her and quietly explained what he had just heard. "They've had a serious problem. They can't use the command module at all." Suddenly the house was filled with her closest friends and neighbors. They stood in her living room in anguish. Someone turned on the television set, and there was ABC's Jules Bergman intoning the grim worst. He was all but saying the three astronauts were doomed. Marilyn felt the grip of panic. She hurried out of the living room, away from the crowd, and headed for the bedroom and then into the master bathroom, locking the door behind her. In tears, she sank to her knees and prayed to God to bring Jim back to her alive. 9:38 p.m. 13, we've got lots and lots of people working on this. We'll get you some dope as soon as we have it, and you'll be the first to know. Jack Lozma was doing the best he could to be reassuring.
"Oh, thank you," Lovell said quickly. He noticed his mouth was dry.
Even as Lozma spoke, Lovell and his crew were trying to come to grips with their situation. They were 200,000 miles from Earth, getting farther away every second. If only there had been enough electrical power left to operate the service module for even another hour, they might have been able to make what was called a direct abort, firing the SPS engine for all it was worth and executing a big U-turn in space. But even assuming the engine itself hadn't been damaged by the explosion, and there was no way to know, they could not operate it without electricity to open the valves to the combustion chamber, swivel the engine nozzle, and steer the spacecraft through the burn. The SPS was useless, and its 40,000 pounds of propellants were just dead weight. The bottom line was, they were going to the moon. Or more precisely, they were going around it. That would not have been a problem had Apollo 13 been on the free-return trajectory that Apollos 8, 10, and 11 had followed. But when Apollo crews started heading for landing sites in the western regions of the moon,
it became necessary to change the timing of their arrival in order to ensure the proper lighting conditions for the landing. The solution was to make a slight change in their approach to the moon. The new path, known as the hybrid trajectory, also had the advantage of saving fuel. The extra risk from giving up the free return was considered minimal. By firing the SBS to place them on the hybrid path, went the logic, the astronauts would demonstrate that the engine was healthy and would work properly to get them into and out of lunar orbit. The very act of throwing away their free ticket home would demonstrate that they didn't need it. As proof, Pete Conrad's crew had used the hybrid trajectory on Apollo 12 without mishap. It had always been assumed that any failure bad enough to cripple the SBS engine, with all its redundant parts, let alone one that could knock out an entire spacecraft, would kill the crew. No one had anticipated the situation that was shaping up this Monday night. Three very live astronauts with a dead command module, heading for the moon. Lovell and his crew knew that unless they did something to get back on the free return, and soon, before they went around the moon, they would miss the Earth by some 45,000 miles. The only hope was at the other end of the tunnel, Aquarius. Its descent engine had far too little power for a direct abort, but it would suffice to get Apollo 13 back on the free return. Before they could fire the engine, however, they would first have to align Aquarius's navigation platform with the stars. And one glance out the window told the men that would be all but impossible. The sky was filled with particles of debris from the explosion, in a cloud that observers on Earth estimated to be 20 miles across, that caught the sunlight and shone like real stars. Furthermore, the LM's navigation telescope couldn't home in on stars automatically the way the command modules could. There was only one way to align the LM's platform. Lovell and Hayes would have to copy the alignment from the command module's platform and feed the information into the lander's computer. And they would have to act fast. Odyssey was almost out of power. Already, Houston had instructed Swigert to turn off some of the systems. Soon he would have to turn off the rest, including the platform and the computer. Lovell and his crew had arrived at this basic plan when, after an hour and a half of troubleshooting, Jack Losma radioed, "We're starting to think about the LM lifeboat." "That's what we're thinking about, too," Swigert answered, with an unwavering calm that typified the radio transmissions that had gone back and forth across the translunar gulf for the past 90 minutes. As Swigert spoke, the pressure in oxygen tank number one was slowly falling toward zero. Realizing that it was beyond saving, Hayes left his seat in Odyssey and headed back through the tunnel to Aquarius. When the emergency began, Ken Mattingly had left the viewing room and taken a seat next to Jack Losma, where he plugged in a headset. He listened to the voices on the flight director's loop as Gene Kranz and his controllers grappled with the bewildering mess that was unfolding 200,000 miles out in space. As an expert on the command module, Mattingly knew it was serious as soon as he heard Lovell and Swigert report the electrical failures. The crisis brought him right out of his funk. His thoughts now were of his crewmates and how he might help bring them back. It wasn't hard to understand why Mattingly, and everyone else in mission control, reacted to the emergency with disbelief. In this business, there were certain well-based assumptions. Things broke, but they never did physical damage to the spacecraft in the process. It went without saying that oxygen tanks didn't explode. Listening to the voices of Kranz's men on the flight director's loop, Mattingly could tell that no one had a handle on the problem. The situation changed when Glenn Lunny took over the flight director's chair. A seasoned veteran at age 33, Lunny had the uncanny ability to go right to the heart of the most complex problem. Now, as Mattingly listened, Lunny proceeded to give an inspiring performance. At first he, like Kranz, focused his efforts on trying to save the command module. When it became clear that this was impossible, Lunny put his LM experts to work coming up with a new checklist to let the astronauts power up Aquarius as quickly as possible. There were those in mission control, including one or two off-duty astronauts, who took one look at Odyssey's oxygen readings and privately concluded that NASA had lost three good men. But Glenn Lunny didn't have time for any such thoughts.
Mattingly heard him feeding rapid-fire questions and instructions to his controllers, keeping tabs on the dying command module and checking the progress on the lunar module checklist. He and his men were now marching together toward a clear goal to get Apollo 13 back on the free return trajectory and then home to Earth. Meanwhile, Gene Kranz organized controllers and specialists into teams to work on the rest of the recovery effort. How quickly should they bring Apollo 13 home? To answer that, they would have to know how long Aquarius's supplies would last. What about the command module? Could it be powered up after days in the cold of space? Unlike the crises that had threatened the first lunar landing and the launch of Apollo 12, this drama would play itself out over a span of days. Already the simulators were being cranked up so that astronauts could test new procedures devised by Kranz's teams, and across the country, thousands of NASA and contractor workers were mobilizing to save the three men in deep space. 11:13 p.m. "Didn't think I'd be back so soon," Hayes said as he set to work turning on the Aquarius's systems. Time was critical now. As written, the shortest possible activation checklist took 2 hours, but there were only minutes of electrical power left in Odyssey. Jack Losma passed up instructions from the LM experts who were working furiously to pare the procedure down to the bare minimum. Meanwhile, inside Odyssey, where only the computer and the cabin lights were still turned on, Swigert had switched over to one of the command module's batteries, knowing that most of its power had to be saved for re-entry. While Hayes worked, Lovell handled the critical transfer of the platform alignment from Odyssey to Aquarius. "Do it right," Hayes cautioned his commander. "Take your time." To convert the data from Odyssey's platform to Aquarius's frame of reference, Lovell had to go through a fill-in-the-blanks conversion using a worksheet that was printed in the flight plan. He remembered that he had made errors when he'd done this during simulations, but he and Hayes both knew he could not afford a mistake now. "I want you to double-check my arithmetic on these numbers," Lovell radioed to Losma. Once Lovell received confirmation from Earth, Hayes entered the data into Aquarius's computer, and moments later the platform was aligned with the heavens. Minutes later, after Hayes had activated the LM's maneuvering thrusters, there was no longer any need to keep Odyssey alive on precious battery power. Lovell yelled up the tunnel to Swigert, "Shut her down!" 9 minutes before midnight, Swigert turned off the last system, and Odyssey fell dark. Sometime after midnight, Lovell and Hayes were in the midst of their work when Swigert floated into the LM cabin, a forlorn expression on his face. They understood. He had just put a friend to sleep. Swigert looked at his crewmates and said, "It's up to you now." After midnight, Tuesday, April 14th. Even now, oxygen spewed from Odyssey's side like blood from a harpooned whale. The escaping gas acted like a small rocket, fighting Lovell's efforts to stabilize the joined craft, which the astronauts called the stack. With Aquarius's thrusters, Lovell soon found that trying to control the stack from the lander was strange and awkward, like steering a loaded wheelbarrow down the street with a long broom handle. When he nudged the hand controller, the joined craft wobbled unpredictably. It was, Lovell would say later, like learning to fly all over again, and he had to learn fast because if he let the spacecraft drift uncontrolled, there was a danger that one of Aquarius's gyros would be immobilized, a condition called gimbal lock that would ruin the alignment of the navigation platform. With no way of sighting on stars, there would be no hope of realigning it. Mindful of this, Hayes said, "Why the hell are we maneuvering at all now?" The strain of the moment was in his voice. "Are we still venting?" "I can't take that doggone roll out," Lovell said. Throughout the next 2 hours, Lovell wrestled with his unwieldy craft as the time for the free return maneuver approached. He wondered if Aquarius would be able to point them toward home and whether it would last long enough to get them there. Lovell and his crew had become the first astronauts to face the very real possibility of dying in space. If the free return maneuver wasn't successful, Apollo 13 would miss the Earth by thousands of miles and continue to circle endlessly in the void. Years later, people would ask him whether he carried suicide pills, and he would answer that in all his years with NASA, he had never heard of such a thing. There wasn't any need for them in a spacecraft. All that was necessary to take one's own life was to open the hatch. and even if he knew he were doomed, he would continue to transmit data back to Earth as long as the radio held out, or until he and his crew had succumbed to lack of oxygen. But Lovell was determined to avoid that kind of death. At all costs, he told himself, he and his crew must get back to Earth, even if they did not survive. Better to burn up in the atmosphere, Lovell thought, than to become the first human beings never to return to their home planet. 2:40 a.m. After an hour of preparation, Lovell and Hayes were ready to fire Aquarius's engine for the free return maneuver. Apollo 13 was oriented correctly and held in position by the LM's computerized autopilot. Just let that computer keep working, Hayes thought. He knew this burn required enough precision that orienting the spacecraft by hand might not be good enough. At one point during the preparations, Capcom Jack Lozma joked, "How do you like this sim?" Lovell answered wryly, "It's a beauty." At 2:42 a.m., the descent engine rumbled to life at minimum power. Lovell waited 10 seconds, then slid the throttle to 40%. Lovell and Hayes, standing, felt themselves pressed gently against the floor. Swigert settled onto the ascent engine cover. 21 seconds later, the computer shut down the engine automatically, precisely, perfectly. The burn was so good that Lovell and Hayes didn't need to make any adjustments with the maneuvering thrusters. For the first time, the men let themselves believe they would make it back to Earth. Another engine firing to hasten the homeward voyage still lay ahead after Apollo 13 swung around the moon, but the worst was over, or so they thought. 2. The moon is a harsh mistress. Tuesday, April 14th, 3:30 a.m., Houston time, 2 days, 14 hours, 17 minutes, mission elapsed time. Fred Hayes looked at his watch and was amazed to see that more than 6 hours had passed since the accident. He had been so absorbed in getting the LM activated, then preparing for the burn, that he had been completely unaware of time. Hours had passed this way, in intense activity that was punctuated by breathing spells as he waited for mission control to verify his work. During those brief respites, Hayes registered a swift succession of images beyond Aquarius's triangular windows. A cloud of debris particles sparkling in the black sky, the moon looming before him, big and close. He could scarcely believe how thoroughly his reality had changed in such a short time. It seemed like only minutes since he and Lovell were putting on their television show in this same tiny cabin. Fred Hayes, who had been flying for NASA since 1959, applied for the astronaut corps not out of any particular desire to go into space, but because it made sense to him to go where his agency was concentrating most of its resources. He was a member of the 5th astronaut group, the ones who called themselves the Original 19. There was more than a trace of irony in the nickname. They were the third string, the bench warmers, the red shirts of the astronaut office. Their chances of getting a seat on an Apollo mission seemed slim to non-existent. But the 19 took the lead in one very important area, hardware. With most of the more senior astronauts already in training for Gemini or Apollo, many of the 19 were assigned to represent the astronaut office at contractors' plants. Some, like Jack Swigert and Ken Mattingly, were detailed to Downey to help shepherd the first command modules through testing. Others, including Hayes and a Navy pilot named Edgar Mitchell, were assigned to Grumman, and their life became the lunar module. Hayes all but lived at the factory. He developed the kind of intimacy with the craft that only a company pilot gets. He knew far more about the guts of the lander than anyone needed to know in order to fly it. He knew what the relays looked like. He knew which pins on the electrical connectors went to which systems. He knew just about every one of the odd, one-of-a-kind parts that Grumman fashioned at the height of the weight-saving crunch. More nights than he could count, Hayes had curled up on the floor of a lunar module and catnapped while a test was delayed. After 2 years of this, he felt he knew the machine almost like a part of himself. He had unwavering confidence in Aquarius, but he also knew that he and his crewmates were asking it to perform in ways it had not been designed for. From here on, they were on untried ground. Aquarius was designed to support two men for 45 hours, a time span that included a systems checkout, the lunar landing, a 33-hour stay on the surface with two moonwalks, and the rendezvous with the command module. Now, Lovell's crew would ask it to support three men for perhaps twice as long. The journey back to Earth would take anywhere from 77 to 100 hours, depending on what kind of engine firing the men made after rounding the moon. The situation was pure black and white. Aquarius would have to function at less than half its normal ration of supplies, or Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes would not be alive when they reached Earth. Immediately after he and Lovell returned to the LM, Hayes began doing mental calculations of oxygen, power, water, and other consumables. Later, when there was a lull, he got out his books, where he had data on every one of the lander's systems, along with actual flight performance from previous lunar modules. Would Aquarius's reserves be enough? Hayes didn't even bother calculating oxygen. He knew without checking that there was more than enough for the trip home. First, there were the oxygen tanks in the lander's descent and ascent stages. Then, the oxygen in the backpacks he and Lovell would have used on the moon. And finally, a set of emergency bottles in the command module. In all, there was enough oxygen to keep three men alive for 8 or 10 days. In other words, more than twice as much as they needed. Hayes's worry was electrical power. Unlike the command module, the LM had no fuel cells and relied solely on batteries. Fully charged, Aquarius's batteries were good for roughly 2 days of normal operation. It was obvious that the only way to stretch them to 4 days was to turn off most of the LM's systems, cabin lights, gauges, and after the next rocket firing was over, even the computer, and he knew mission control would have them do just that. Hayes went down through the list of the items he knew they wouldn't turn off. Radio, 1.29 amps. Environmental control system, 5.85 amps. Hayes figured it would take about 18 or 20 amps to keep Aquarius going at a bare minimum, about as much as a 1970 vintage refrigerator and color television would consume together, and less than half the 50 amps the LM used in normal operation. Aquarius's batteries could supply 20 amps for 100 hours, enough to see them home, and at best, perhaps a full day's worth more than they'd need. But battery power alone would not keep the LM running. Electronic gear gets hot, and it must be cooled to keep functioning. The most precious substance aboard Aquarius wasn't oxygen or food. It was cooling water, and Hayes found that the 338 pounds stored in Aquarius's tanks weren't enough to last the trip. By his calculations, Aquarius was probably going to run out of water about 5 hours before re-entry. That would have been an ominous prediction if not for an important bit of data from Apollo 11. Before Neil Armstrong and his crew cast off Eagle's ascent stage in lunar orbit, they began an experiment. They left everything inside the lander operating, but deliberately turned off the water supply. Eagle was a good soldier. It transmitted valuable data right up until it overheated and died. If Aquarius was as good a ship as Eagle, and Hayes was sure that it was, then even if the water ran out, Aquarius's systems would keep running for about 8 hours more. That left 3 hours to spare. When Hayes had finished his calculations, he knew that if nothing else went wrong, they would probably make it. And when Mission Control called with their own assessment of the situation, Hayes realized that the LM experts, more than 200,000 miles away, had reached the same conclusions. With the free return maneuver out of the way, Hayes found himself exhausted and emotionally drained. The normal flight plan had gone out the window after the emergency, and with it, normal rest periods. It had been more than a full day since the men had slept, and Houston recommended they set up watches. Lovell decided that he and Swigert would stand watch in the LM while Hayes slept in the command module. That way, either himself or Hayes would always be available to take care of Aquarius. "I'll wake you up," Lovell said, and Hayes headed for Odyssey. 6:24 a.m.
Jack Swigert and Jim Lovell floated in Aquarius while Hayes slept in Odyssey. Every hour, Lovell had to use Aquarius's thrusters to rotate the stack 90 degrees so that the sun's warmth would be evenly distributed on the hull. Normally, this was done by the command module computer, but the LM's computer had no software to perform this slow-motion barbecue spin. Lovell had to perform the maneuvers by hand. Even this simple task was made difficult by the unwieldy craft, but at length he managed it. Now, as the stack turned, the moon slid into view. Already it was close enough to see craters with the unaided eye. "That old moon's getting bigger and bigger, Jack." Jim Lovell and Jack Swigert did not know each other very well. They had arrived at NASA 4 years apart, and as a backup crewman, Swigert had not worked closely with Lovell until the day he took Ken Mattingly's place. In some ways, Swigert and Mattingly were opposites. Both were bachelors, but that was where the similarity ended. Mattingly's whole life seemed to revolve around the program. He appeared to have no social life whatsoever. He was an ascetic monk at the monastery of Apollo. Once, when a reporter asked him whether he had any plans to get married, Mattingly blushed and jingled the change in his pocket. Swigert, meanwhile, was a world-class bachelor who pursued his calling with the same methodical, fastidious approach he brought to test flying. His date book included codes that signified single, divorced, or widowed. His success with women was at once legendary and utterly mysterious. More than one astronaut who teased Swigert about the way he dressed. He wore white socks with a suit and tie, his feet were flat, and the sides of his shoes wore out before the soles. Had to will his jaw shut when Swigert showed up with a drop-dead gorgeous date. They knew Swigert was doing just as well wherever his T-38 took him, but those who worked with Swigert knew his dedication to Apollo. After the fire, when it was time to get down to rewriting checklists and procedures, Swigert had been tireless. His battle cry was persistence. Even after NASA turned him down twice, for the second and third astronaut selections, Swigert was back to do battle with the ink blots and the treadmill in 1966. This time he won. When talk about replacing Mattingly started, Lovell spoke to Tom Paine to try and stop it. He had nothing against Jack Swigert, but Mattingly knew the command module down to the last detail, and Lovell had come to depend on him. He told the NASA administrator that if Mattingly got sick, it would probably be on the way home, with no impact on the mission. But Paine refused to overturn Chuck Berry's recommendation. It wasn't worth the risk, he said, especially since an illness would bring NASA a great deal of negative publicity. Lovell realized he had no choice but to accept the situation. But taking Swigert onto the crew was no simple matter. It was true that Swigert was a command module expert, having lived with the craft at North American the way Hayes had done with the LM at Grumman. When it came to the emergency procedures for command module malfunctions, Swigert literally wrote the book. He was one of the only astronauts who actually went to Deke Slayton and asked to be a command module pilot. The problem was that Swigert had been training with John Young and Charlie Duke for 8 months. He'd forged a close working relationship with them. He was used to their techniques. Now, with launch only days away, he was switching crews. Would he be able to mesh with Lovell and Hayes in the critical phases of the mission? During an emergency rendezvous, there would be no chance to explain verbal shorthand like, "You've got the next burn." Lovell told Tom Paine he'd agree to the switch on one condition. This shotgun marriage would have to be tested in the simulator. And so in the last days of their training, just when they should have been taking it a little easier, Lovell and Hayes were in the simulator for hours on end, running through practice launches and rendezvous with Swigert. By Friday, they knew the marriage was going to work. But by launch day, the sadness they felt for Ken Mattingly and the annoyance with the daily blood tests and other medical hassles of the past week all but robbed them of the excitement of going. When the three men arrived at the White Room, sealed in their spacesuits, the usual exuberance of the closeout technicians was gone. They were subdued and nervous. Still, Lovell knew, if he and Hayes had been through ups and downs, that was nothing compared to what Swigert had been through. Any astronaut who had ever served on a backup crew knew that the experience is an emotional roller coaster. All through the long months of training,
the backup man keeps himself motivated with the hope that he might get to go instead of the prime crewman. About a month before the flight, he realizes he's not going after all. A week before the launch of Apollo 13, Jack Swigert was in the same position as every other backup crew member before him. He had been mentally and emotionally backed down from the mission for weeks. His biggest worry was finding hotel rooms on the beach for the prime crew's launch guests. Then Charlie Duke got German measles. And as it turned out, Swigert had fit in extremely well, Lovell thought. In the first 2 days of the flight, while everything was still going normally, Swigert had proved the benefits of standardized training. He handled his role with professionalism and skill. As much as Lovell hated to lose Mattingly, he had to admit that things were probably going to work out okay. Until Monday night, Lovell could only imagine what Swigert was thinking now. Since midnight Tuesday, Jack Swigert had been a man without a spacecraft. As long as they were in Aquarius, Swigert would not do any flying. He had barely set foot inside the LM simulator. He was a spectator, perched atop the can-shaped ascent engine cover in the back of the cabin while Lovell and Hayes worked. The lander seemed so unsettlingly delicate. At one point he was about to take a picture of the moon, and Hayes cautioned him not to hit the window with the camera. It might break. And he heard strange, distressing sounds. The LM whined and squealed. It gurgled. He asked Lovell and Hayes, "Is there something wrong with the environmental control system?" They reassured him, "Those sounds are normal. The time to worry is when you don't hear them." Now, Swigert watched as Lovell struggled to turn the spacecraft. Through the windows, he could see the moon as a pockmarked half-circle, then the Earth, tiny and radiant. It had looked small before the bang. Now it seemed even smaller. It was hard for Swigert to accept the fact that the best way to get back there was to keep going away from it. About 12 hours from now, at 6:30 this evening, Apollo 13 would swing around the moon and make its closest approach, or Paracynthian, above the far side. 2 hours later, according to the plan devised by Mission Control, the men would fire up Aquarius's descent engine once more. Much would depend on that firing, which was known as the PC plus 2 burn, short for Paracynthian plus 2 hours. Without it, the trip home would take a total of 4 days. With it, that time could be trimmed to as little as 2.5 days. The increased margins on Aquarius's supplies could mean the difference between making it and not making it. In addition, it would shift the splashdown point from the Indian Ocean, where the Navy had few ships, to the South Pacific, where the recovery force was now stationed. But Swigert, with less confidence in this unfamiliar machine than in his own, looked ahead to the PC plus 2 burn with some anxiety. He asked Lovell, "Do they think we'll have any trouble doing the next burn?" "Probably not, if everything holds together," was Lovell's assessment. "We've already made one burn." But then, in a matter-of-fact tone, he added, "Well, Jack, this is going to be touch and go." He seemed to be talking about the entire journey home, not just the next burn. Tuesday morning, Timber Cove, Texas. For Marilyn Lovell, the past 12 hours had been a vigil by the squawk box. The men had turned off their radio's amplifier to save power, and sometimes their words were nearly drowned out by static. It helped to have some of the other astronauts in the house, including Pete Conrad, explain to her what was going on, and she took some measure of comfort from the presence of friends, including Susan Borman, Jane Conrad, and Betty Benware. Marilyn's memory of these next hours would be hazy. She would be told later that she lit one cigarette after another, setting them down here and there while friends followed behind, putting them out. In the morning, she sent young Jeffrey, age 4, off to nursery school as if nothing were wrong, but her 2 daughters stayed home. She had already talked by phone to her son James, 15, who was at a Wisconsin military academy. Earlier, Marilyn had worried about Jim's mother, who had recently suffered a stroke and was in a nearby nursing home. If she found out about the emergency, Marilyn feared it might kill her. So Marilyn called the home to have the television in her room turned off. But in the Lovell house, the TV was on, and ABC News's gloomy prognosis so upset Marilyn's younger daughter, 11-year-old Susan, that the girl burst into tears. "He's coming back," Marilyn reassured her. There's just no reason why he isn't coming back.
Marilyn knew it was a white lie. She'd asked some of the NASA people about the odds of saving the men, and they'd been honest with her. 10%. But she also knew that she could not give in to her terror, imagining awful scenarios the way she had when Jim was a test pilot at Patuxent River. Besides, other people had already done that for her. Last year, she and Jim had gone to the premiere of a movie called Marooned in Houston. In the movie, three Apollo astronauts are stranded in Earth orbit after their engine fails to ignite for retrofire. Before long, Mission Control has run out of ideas, and the head of NASA's manned space program, played by Gregory Peck, is spelling out the doom scenario to a closed-door meeting of his deputies. If necessary, on Wednesday morning, the president will issue a message to the nation emphasizing the courage and determination of the crew and their final wish that the program be continued without pause. But the chief astronaut, played by David Janssen, will have none of it. He slams the table and barks, "I don't give a damn about the next mission." Before long, he's convinced NASA to launch a rescue mission with himself as the pilot. And the rescue succeeds, but not before the mission commander, whose name is Jim, is killed in a spacewalking attempt to fix the engine. Marilyn did not find Marooned very entertaining. But the movie was far from Marilyn's thoughts. She knew she must put fear out of her mind, or she would not last through this ordeal. After Father Reich came by to conduct a private mass, her spirits were lifted, and she carried herself with a calm that amazed her friends. Susan Borman said, "I hope the Navy's proud of you." Meanwhile, the squawk box relayed the voices of Jim and his crew amid static. The men were on hot mic, and every once in a while it was possible to hear them talking to one another. Their voices did not show any signs of strain. She knew Jim's attitude about panic. Where would it get him? After you bounce off the walls a few times, Jim would say, you're right back where you started. Right now, Jim was telling Jack Swigert to fill up some juice bags with drinking water from the command module. And then it was possible to hear Jack greet a returning Fred Hayes. Come on in, Freddo. Did you sleep good? Not long after, Jim Lovell could be heard clearly saying, with some fatigue in his voice, look it, I gotta get some sleep. 12:42 p.m. Jim Lovell was back in Aquarius after only 3 hours. Unable to stop thinking about the situation, he hadn't slept. Had they missed anything? Could they find a way to stretch the LM supplies even further? He'd seen Hayes's numbers, but he had a hard time believing them. He wondered about the forecasts coming from Mission Control. They were a little too positive, a little too vague, and it occurred to Lovell that things might be worse than they were willing to admit. Lovell's thoughts turned to the PC-plus-2 burn set for about 7.5 hours from now. At that point, some 20 hours would have elapsed since he and Hayes had aligned Aquarius's platform. Lovell knew that there was a chance the gyros could have drifted out of alignment, perhaps only slightly, but still enough to affect the accuracy of the maneuver. There was no way to check it against the stars. The sky beyond Aquarius's windows was still a blizzard of debris particles. The only chance to see stars would be during the half-hour that Apollo 13 flew through the moon's shadow. Lovell knew he might eat up those precious minutes, simply maneuvering the stack to bring stars into sight of the LM's telescope. There had to be some other way. Houston had figured out an answer, and at 1:42 p.m., a now-healthy Charlie Duke took the Capcom mic to read up the procedure, and Lovell didn't like what he heard. He and Hayes were to test the alignment by sighting on the one star they could see, the sun. Mission Control would send up a set of coordinates, which Lovell would use to steer the craft into position. If the alignment was good, the sun would show up in the eyepiece of the navigation telescope. It didn't have to be perfect, they said. Even a 1-degree error in alignment would be okay, as long as the telescope crosshairs were touching the sun's disk. Lovell agreed, but he had real doubts it would work. But the alternative, sighting on stars during the brief minutes in the lunar shadow, he liked even less. It was around 3 o'clock p.m. when Lovell wrestled Apollo 13 into position. The task was even more difficult now, because the attitude indicator, or 8-ball, had been turned off to save power, and judging orientation from the computer's readouts was awkward. In Houston,
Flight Director Jerry Griffin waited with great anxiety. He knew this was one of the most critical moments of the flight. Lovell wished Griffin and his controllers could look over his shoulder, but they told him now that they were having trouble locking up on Aquarius's telemetry. Lovell would have to do the best he could without them. Now the solar glare filled Aquarius's windows. While Lovell sighted through the telescope, Hayes checked the readouts. Lovell made a correction to the attitude, then moved aside and let Hayes look. Lovell asked anxiously, "What have you got?" Through the dark protective filter, Hayes saw a bright arc, upper right corner of the sun. "We've got it!" Lovell exclaimed. In Houston, the flight controllers cheered, and Jerry Griffin's hands trembled as he wrote the successful result in his log. Nearly 3 hours later, Apollo 13 flew into the moon's shadow. Outside, where the sky was suddenly filled with stars, the men could see dark silhouettes, which they realized were debris from their explosion. Somewhere out ahead was the moon. Lovell knew he would not see it clearly as well this time as he had on Apollo 8, for Apollo 13 would come no closer than 136 miles. The encounter would be a fleeting one, for they would be moving so fast it would take just half an hour to round the far side, and only 20 minutes of that would be in sunlight. For Jim Lovell, the small, lifeless world that had been his goal for 8 years was now simply a waypoint along a troubled journey. At 6:21 p.m., his headset filled with static as Apollo 13 flew out of contact with Earth. 6:29 p.m. With blinding suddenness, the sun reappeared. Reassuringly, it was exactly when Houston had predicted, and up in Odyssey, Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes were glued to the windows. Nothing could have prepared them for a sight as alien as the far side of the moon, and for the first time since the accident, they forgot their life-or-death situation. As the craft sped past the cratered ball, Swigert and Hayes fired off pictures. "If we don't get this burn off," Lovell told them impatiently, "you won't get your pictures developed." "Relax, Jim," Hayes said. "You've been here before, and we haven't." Like a billiard ball in bank shot, Apollo 13 rounded the moon, its path bent by the lunar gravity. Soon it would be pointing back toward Earth. And now Lovell joined his crew at the windows, pointing out places that only he had seen before, until Houston was on the radio once more. As the full moon shrank into the distance, Lovell and Hayes went back to work. 8:40 p.m. Because of Lovell's anxiety to get ready for the PC-plus-2 burn, he and Hayes finished powering up the LM almost an hour ahead of schedule. Lovell thought of all the power they were wasting just sitting there waiting, and he chided himself for jumping the gun. Finally, he and Hayes stood at Aquarius's controls, ready for the maneuver. Because the command module was attached, a situation the LM software wasn't written to accommodate, Lovell had to fire the engine by hand. When the time came, he pushed the engine start button, waited 5 seconds, and slid the throttle to 40%. "We're burning," he told Houston. 21 seconds later, the computer throttled up to full power. Lovell was amazed at how smooth and quiet it was. This engine was a beauty. He wished he were using it to land on the moon right then. For the first time since the accident, Jack Swigert's spirits lifted. Every second brought them closer to home instead of farther away from it. If Aquarius held out for another 62 hours, and based on Mission Control's latest estimates, there seemed no doubt that it would, they would make it back to Earth. At the same time, Swigert knew, everything they had accomplished so far would be for naught if Odyssey didn't function properly when they got there. Aquarius was their lifeboat, but only Odyssey could ferry them through the Earth's atmosphere to splashdown. Right now, the command module was nothing more than an inert shell. Swigert called it the upstairs bedroom. No one had ever tried to revive a dead command module after more than 3.5 days of forced hibernation in space. Mission Control would have to invent the necessary procedures. Swigert had already spent some time thinking it over in his own mind. First, align the computer, then get the entry monitor system going. But the checklist was far too massive for him to devise on his own. He would need to have it in writing, carefully scripted, down to the last circuit breaker, and it would have to work right the first time. There would be no postponing re-entry.
Swigert knew only too well that under normal circumstances it took 3 months to write a re-entry checklist, test it in the simulator, and work the bugs out. The people in Houston had less than 2 days left to finish this one. But in the back rooms of Building 30, down the hall from Mission Control, the re-entry checklist was just one of the many efforts which consumed engineers and mission planners. Ken Mattingly was in the thick of it, going around on a freelance basis wherever the action was and wherever he could be of use. In each room, teams of specialists huddled over schematics and scribbled calculations on blackboards, facing problems like how to conserve power or water or how to align the guidance system without a computer. For more than 3 years, they had been thinking of what-if situations and what to do about them. To Mattingly, the most amazing thing was that nearly every solution the teams were coming up with had already been thought of and sometimes even tested in previous missions. Firing the LM's engines while it was docked to the command module, for example, was one of the engineering tests crammed into the 10-day Apollo 9 flight. Then there was the carbon dioxide problem. The LM was equipped with round canisters of lithium hydroxide to scrub exhaled carbon dioxide out of the cabin air, but there were only enough canisters to handle 2 men for about 2 days, not 3 men for more than 3 days. Carbon dioxide buildup would kill them as surely as anything else. First would come bad headaches. Then their hearts would begin to race. Finally, they would grow drowsy and drift off into a sleep from which they would never wake up. The command module had plenty of canisters, but they were square, the wrong shape for the LM's environmental control system. Unless some way could be found to use command module canisters in the LM, Lovell's crew would suffocate from their own breath. Someone remembered a simulation from Apollo 8 in which the cabin fans had failed, leaving the air inside the command module dangerously stagnant, and the engineers had figured out that, in principle, it would be possible to build a makeshift air purifier using only items that were readily available in the spacecraft, a plastic cover from a checklist book, a plastic storage bag, and so on. Now, 18 months later, they would have to build this contraption for real, and make it work in an entirely different spacecraft. Then they would have to figure out how to describe it so the crew could build it without a blueprint or a picture of the finished product. That alone had kept a team from Deke Slayton's Crew Systems Division busy since the first hours after the accident. It was one thing to have the pieces of Apollo 13's recovery in hand. It was another to put them together and make them work. On the rare occasions when Mattingly stepped outside, he saw the whole space center lit up with activity. The lights were on for 24 hours a day in the offices of anyone who had anything to do with Apollo. At the Grumman plant on Long Island, North American in Downey, and contractors around the country, people showed up at their offices after the first reports of trouble, and they did not leave. Around the world, Apollo 13 had drawn the attention of more people than any other space mission except the first lunar landing. Headlines from Toronto to Tokyo blared the message that Apollo was in danger. News bulletins cut into radio and TV programs to report new developments. Crowds gathered anywhere there was a television set. In Rome, Pope Paul VI prayed for the astronauts' return before an audience of 10,000 people. At a religious festival in India, pilgrims numbering 10 times as many offered prayers for the astronauts. Jim Lovell had no way of knowing that when he'd imagined Apollo 13 would be a mere footnote to history, he'd been very wrong. 10:16 p.m. "We've gone a hell of a long time without any sleep," Lovell said to his crew, his voice thick with fatigue. Still on hot mic, he added, "I didn't get hardly any sleep last night at all." After the PC-plus-2 burn, there had been much to do, including getting the joint craft back into a thermal control spin, still a difficult and frustrating task. Now that was done, but there were other things to worry about. He and Hayes were powering down the LM, and at Mission Control's request, they were about to turn off the guidance system and the computer. It was the last thing he ever imagined he would do intentionally aboard a spacecraft heading for the moon. When the time came to pull the circuit breaker,
He double-checked with Capcom Vance Brand. If there were any more mid-course burns to make, Houston would have to come up with a way of making them without the computer. When Brand said they were working on just that, Lovell kept his skepticism to himself. Swigert, meanwhile, was doing some worrying of his own. Which control system, he asked Brand, would Houston want him to use for re-entry? Mission Control had asked him to make a check on one of Odyssey's electrical buses. Did they think it was okay? Suddenly Swigert heard a familiar voice. We think you guys are in great shape all around, Deke Slayton said. Why don't you quit worrying and go to sleep? Well, I think we might just do that, replied Jim Lovell, his tone suddenly more energetic. Or part of us will. Wednesday, April 15th, 12:44 a.m. Houston time, 3 days, 11 hours, 31 minutes, mission elapsed time. The moon had dwindled steadily since the PC-plus-2 burn. Now, some 19,000 miles away, it was about the size of a golf ball at arm's length. But that was still close enough to see craters with the unaided eye, and Fred Hayes, alone in Aquarius while his crewmates slept in the upstairs bedroom, took some time to look at it. Near the Terminator, just emerging from night, he could barely make out the highland region called Fra Mauro, where he and Lovell were to land. And if it was a strange and alien place, then it had become only too familiar to Hayes. As backup to Buzz Aldrin on Apollo 11, he'd mastered the technical and physical demands of getting to the surface of the moon and working there. By the time he began preparing for Apollo 13, Hayes was a trained geologic observer who was as excited about the science of his mission as the flying. But the moon beyond Aquarius's windows was the face of disappointment. At least he could feel good about Aquarius. Right now, with only the environmental control system and the radio going, the lander was drawing just a bit more than 12 amps, far less than Hayes had figured on. When this flight was over, people would really know what a lunar module could do. Aquarius was the reason Hayes had been able to sleep for 5 hours the morning after the accident. He'd trusted his calculations, and it turned out he'd been right. Lovell hadn't found it as easy to accept Hayes's results, but Hayes knew commanders tended to worry. With almost nothing to do himself, at the moment his only job was switching from one antenna to another as the spacecraft slowly turned, Hayes's thoughts turned to Houston. From what the Capcoms had been saying, he could just imagine the massive round-the-clock effort by the flight controllers and engineers. Apollo 13 had become their mission, their test, far more than it was his. According to Jack Lozma, things were going so well that they were already planning for splashdown. He asked Hayes, "How would you like to spend a week on an aircraft carrier getting back?" "If I can get on an aircraft carrier," Hayes answered. "I don't care how long it takes, Jack." 3. The Chill of Space. Wednesday, April 15th, 3:04 a.m., Houston time, 3 days, 13 hours, 51 minutes, mission elapsed time. Fred is being relieved now. He went back to get some rest. This is Lovell here who's got the duty. "Gee whiz," said a surprised Jack Lozma. "You got up kind of early, didn't you?" In fact, Lovell had returned to Aquarius after little more than 3 hours. In part, it was because he knew Hayes was tired. In part, it was because he could not stop thinking about what lay ahead. But mostly, it was because it had become very cold in the command module. Yesterday morning, when he and Swigert had tried to sleep there, sunlight had shafted through the windows, keeping them awake, and they had put up the window shades. Normally, that wouldn't have been a mistake. But with Odyssey systems shut down, the shades removed the only other source of heat, sunlight, from the cabin. Now it was as wet and cold as a damp cellar. Moisture from the men's breath and perspiration had condensed into a thin film of water droplets all over the walls, the instrument panel, the windows. Lovell tried to rest there after midnight Wednesday, but the chill penetrated the flimsy fabric of his sleeping bag. It was remarkable, though, how weightlessness affected things. He found that if he stayed perfectly still, his own body heat built up around him like a tenuous blanket, because there was no convection to carry it away, but his slightest motion dispelled this warmth and let in the cold. Finally, he gave up trying to sleep. Back in Aquarius, Lovell had something new to worry about. Jack Lozma had informed him that Apollo 13 was straying off course for re-entry. As a veteran of one lunar re-entry, Lovell knew only too well the narrow cone of safety the command module would have to fly through. Something was making Apollo 13's flight path too shallow. Lozma said a mid-course correction burn was planned for about 9 p.m., Wednesday evening. Lovell couldn't imagine how he would align the spacecraft properly for the burn with no computer or guidance system, but Lozma said they were working on it. 7:22 a.m. Even the carbon dioxide problem hadn't escaped Fred Hayes when he did his calculations on Aquarius's consumables, but when he totaled up the number of lithium hydroxide canisters and decided there were enough, he only figured on two men. He forgot that Swigert had to breathe too. Fortunately, the engineers on the ground had been on top of the problem, and they'd radioed word about their plan to have Hayes and his crewmates construct an air purifier. It would be like building a model airplane, they said, but it would end up looking more like a mailbox. By Wednesday morning, Lovell and Swigert had gathered together the necessary materials: two lithium hydroxide canisters from Odyssey, a couple of pieces of cardboard from a flight plan book, a couple of plastic storage bags, and the stuff Hayes called space-age baling wire, gray tape. While Hayes slept in Odyssey, Lovell and Swigert listened as Capcom Joe Kerwin described the procedure. "Now then," Kerwin began, "we want you to take the tape and cut out two pieces about 3 feet long, or a good arm's length, and what we want you to do with them is make two belts around the sides of the canister." It was an elegant creation. Lovell and Swigert were told to encase each canister in one of the plastic bags, affixing the bag with tape. Before that, however, they were to use the cardboard to fashion a little archway over the top of the canister to keep the bag from getting sucked against the canister's inlet screens. The next step is to stop up the bypass hole in the bottom of the canister. We recommend that you either use a wet wipe or cut off a piece of a sock and stuff it in there. With all the multi-million-dollar equipment aboard Apollo 13, survival had come down to cardboard, gray tape, and socks. It took about an hour for Lovell and Swigert to finish two of the makeshift air purifiers, and they did resemble a mailbox. In fact, they looked exactly like the air purifier that astronauts and engineers had put together on Earth. Later, after Hayes installed one of them on the end of an oxygen hose, the carbon dioxide level fell toward normal. Looking back on it, the ingenuity and teamwork embodied in that mailbox would amaze him as much as anything on the flight. 1:34 p.m. "Jack, for your information," said Joe Kerwin brightly, "Fido tells me that we are in the Earth's sphere of influence and we're starting to accelerate." It was a piece of news Swigert was glad to hear. "I thought it was about time we crossed," he told Kerwin. "Thank you. We're on our way back home." In Houston, Gene Kranz and his white team of controllers were racing the clock to come up with the re-entry checklist. Nothing would draw more concentrated effort. Kranz split his people into three separate groups. One would write instructions for everything that should happen in the last 4 hours of the flight: powering up the command module, casting off the dead service module, letting go of the LM, and finally the re-entry itself. Another group was to take care of translating the checklist into a form the astronauts could use. A third team would make sure that nothing called for in the checklist exceeded the slim reserves of battery power and water. At the top of their list was the daunting requirement to make the command module's batteries last 3 times longer than their normal 45 minutes. It was all but impossible, but they would have to figure out some way. Before long, the white team was aided by a tiger team of off-duty flight controllers, and Ken Mattingly hunkered down with them. They didn't have any time to waste. Re-entry was only 2 days away. Wednesday evening.
It was time to put Apollo 13 in position for the mid-course correction. Mission Control had instructed Lovell to orient the spacecraft so that the sun shone directly through the LM's small overhead window. Then, looking through his forward-facing window, he would spin the stack around until he saw the Earth, now a blue and white crescent, directly ahead. Then, he would sight on the Earth through a special gun sight, normally used for rendezvous maneuvers, and turn the spacecraft until the horns of the crescent were sitting on the crosshairs. Then, according to Mission Control, he would be in position to make the burn. Earlier, when Lovell heard about this technique, he had a flash of recognition. Someone had dreamed it up during a what-if session before Apollo 8. Since then, it had been taken out of the flight plan books as unlikely and had been long forgotten, except, that is, by the experts in Mission Control. Lovell never would have dreamed, back then, that he would have to stake his life on such a scheme. Around 9 p.m., Hayes copied data for the burn. Almost 90 minutes later, Lovell had wrestled the stack into position. He informed Houston that he was ready for the burn and added that he hoped the guys in the back room knew what they were doing. When the moment came to fire Aquarius's descent engine, all three men played a part. Lovell turned on the engine and controlled the LM's roll. Hayes kept the stack oriented in pitch, and Jack Swigert kept his eye on the clock and called out the start and stop times. 14 seconds after it began, the mid-course burn was over. "Nice work," radioed Jack Losma. "Let's hope it was," Lovell answered. Thursday, April 16th, 3:21 a.m. Houston time. 4 days, 14 hours, 8 minutes mission elapsed time. Lovell was alone on watch while Swigert and Hayes slept. There would be no sleep for Hayes in the cold atmosphere of Odyssey. They had started calling it the refrigerator, so he had brought down one of the sleeping bags. Now he was a strange sight, wrapped in the bag, his weightless body suspended upside down with his feet up in the tunnel and his head above the engine cover. To keep from floating away, he'd hooked the loop on the bag's zipper to the hatch handle. Swigert was down on the floor just beneath the instrument panel. He'd wrapped a restraint harness around his arm to anchor himself. Lovell had found that he could close his eyes and doze off for 15 minutes, floating before Aquarius's controls, and wake up feeling a little refreshed. He didn't feel nearly as exhausted now as he had at the end of those 20 hours in lunar orbit on Apollo 8. The difference was adrenaline. The constant demands of keeping his crew and his spacecraft functioning kept him going. At least now, the end was in sight. From Mission Control, Jack Losma had good news about Aquarius's water. It was holding out so well at the present rate that there was enough to last 20 hours beyond re-entry. "Your luck is really hanging in there," Losma said. Luck. Lovell had to smile at the irony of the word. He wasn't a superstitious man, and so when he found out he'd be flying Apollo 13, he didn't think anything of it. In fact, some of his Italian friends were happy for him. They said 13 was a very lucky number. So much for lucky numbers. And even though, after the accident, he'd wondered, "Why me?" just as Swigert must have, he had to concede that after 572 hours in space, he was a good target for the law of averages. What he hadn't realized at the time was how lucky he'd really been. After the accident, he'd told Swigert and Hayes, it couldn't have happened at a worse time. After all, the explosion occurred just at the point where Apollo 13 was too far from Earth to turn around. But he was wrong, Lovell knew now. If the explosion had happened in lunar orbit,